If you've ever had the opportunity to travel outside your country, you may have had the experience of when you arrived in this foreign country, of that feeling like you were seeing everything in this incredible clarity. Driving into Chicago from O'Hare Airport in the first year of my theological studies, I had traveler's fresh eyes. And the one thing that I saw incredibly clearly was race and color and class. Stronger blacks, warmer browns, paler whites than what I was used to seeing. Layers of color. And I saw class and layers of class. And I saw how color was class. And it stacked up like ancient rock formations. There are times in history that change the trajectory of human evolution, that change a society. When the tensions have built up a pressure large enough to crack and crumble the calcified institutions of power. At these moments, all the world watches and breathes with, and if they can, participates. The legacy of slavery in the United States created the conditions of fear and bigotry that spurred Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to launch a massive campaign in Selma, Alabama in 1965, where less than 2% of the eligible African Americans were registered to vote. Today is the 50th anniversary of the first attempt to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the bridge that led from the town of Selma to the state capital, Montgomery. Now, I can't give you the whole history that led up to the conditions that inspired men and women, black and white, young and old, to risk their lives to change the apartheid system in the U.S. But here are some of the events that led to that momentous, nonviolent civil rights march 50 years ago. 50 years ago today. February 10th, 1965, 165 teenagers gathered peacefully to protest the racist conditions. They were attacked by Sheriff Jim Clark and the police using tear gas, billy clubs, and cattle prods. The injuries were massive. February 18th, a solidarity march outside Selma in support of the attack on the teenagers resulted in dozens of injuries and the mortal wounding of 26-year-old Jimmy Lee Jackson by a state trooper. And Jimmy died 5 days later. The Reverend Martin Luther King then called for a nonviolent protest march from Selma to the state capitol in Montgomery. March 7th, the march begins. As the marchers reach the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they are viciously attacked by the local police. This violence is widely reported across America and around the world on television. The shocking images rivet the world, and the day becomes known as Bloody Sunday. Dr. King sends out a call across North America to all clergy to come to Selma to bear witness to these atrocities. 2 days later, on March 9th, 450 clergy, including 150 Unitarian ministers, joined over 2,000 African Americans for a second attempt to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. When they reached the bridge in the wall of weapon-wielding police, the marchers, taking their clue from Martin Luther King, sank to their knees and prayed. And then they got up and they turned around and headed back to Brown's Chapel, singing, "We Shall Overcome." That night, 38-year-old Unitarian minister James Reeb, who had come to Selma to support the cause of justice, was attacked by a group of white thugs outside a white-only restaurant. 2 days later, James Reeb died. At Reeb's memorial service, a Canadian rabbi from Hamilton, Ontario, read the Jewish Prayer of the Dead. And Reverend Martin Luther King, in his eulogy for Reverend Reeb, spoke these words. We are compelled to ask the question, who killed James Reeb? The answer is simple and rather limited when we think of the who. He was murdered by a few sick, demented, and misguided men who have the strange notion that you express discontent through murder. There is another haunting, poignant, desperate question we are forced to ask this afternoon, that I asked a few days ago when we funeralized James Jackson. It is the question, what killed James Reeb? When we move from the who to the what, the blame is wide and the responsibility grows. James Reeb was killed by the indifference of every minister of the gospel who remained silent behind the safe security of their stained glass windows. He was killed by the irrelevancy of a church that will stand amid social evil and serve as a taillight rather than a headlight, an echo rather than a voice. He was murdered by the irresponsibility of every politician who has ever moved down the path of demagogy, who has fed his constituents with stale bread of hatred and the stale meat of racism. He was murdered by the brutality of every sheriff and law enforcement agent who practices lawlessness in the name of law. And he was killed by the timidity of a federal government that can spend millions of dollars keeping the troops in South Vietnam, yet cannot protect the lives of its own citizens seeking constitutional rights. Yes? He was also murdered by the cowardice of every Negro who tacitly accepts the evil system of segregation, who stands by on the sidelines in the midst of a mighty struggle for justice. So in this death, James Reeb says something to each of us, black and white alike. He says we must substitute courage for caution. He says to us we must be concerned not merely for who murdered him, but for about the system, the way of life, the philosophy that produced the murder. His death says to us we must work passionately, unrelentingly, to make the American dream a reality so that he did not die in vain. So said Martin Luther King. The murder of a white minister and Martin Luther King's nonviolent fight for human dignity and the equality of all people ignited moral souls across the United States. Here in Canada, there were massive nonviolent protest demonstrations in many of the major cities. Thousands of people, led by the newly formed Student Union for Peace Action, sat outside the American consulates in Toronto and Montreal in support of African-American civil rights. I hope you're not surprised by this. When I spoke some of these words to my American colleagues, they were surprised that there was so much care beyond their borders. But wasn't it Martin Luther King Jr. who said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied to a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with the narrow, provincial, outside agitator idea. Arthur Hughes was a young Canadian man in his early 20s, and I have the honor of sharing his story. When I have the hat on, I will be Arthur. I heeded Martin Luther King's call. In fact, we heeded that call. Members of the Toronto Unitarian congregation, we were all well aware of King's plea. There'd been this huge rally in Toronto, and many religious institutions had been alerted by the SCLC regarding the planned civil rights march from Selma to Montgomery. We all knew about the killing of James Reeb. I talked to Reverend John Morgan, our parish minister at First Congregation, and suggested that we needed to do something. And he responded immediately, "Of course we should, and we will. We'll go down and we'll join the march." It was as simple as that. Well, after some planning, it was arranged that I would drive my Chev convertible with four passengers. Rev Morgan, professional down-to-earth guy. Mrs. Newell, a tiny middle-aged widow. Jimmy, a stocky longshoreman with an IQ of 148. And Anita, a teenage student at the University of Toronto. A more desperate group could not have been assembled. But we had something in common. We were all Unitarians, and we all believed deeply in the civil rights movement. We left Toronto at the crack of dawn on Monday, March 22nd, 1965. The following morning, it was warm enough to put the top down on the Chev, and we were feeling quite excited, upbeat. Just after we crossed the Tennessee-Alabama state line, I pulled into a rural service station to gas up. Young fellow sauntered out to us. While he was filling the tank, he said to me, "Where are y'all headed?" I said we were on our way to Birmingham to take part in the big march. He exclaimed, "Oh, reckon you'll be more of them outside agitators then." Well, after bringing the receipt, he came close to me and he said quietly, "Tell you what, mister, better take off that there front license plate. Then when folks see you coming, they'll think you're from hereabouts." I removed the plate and put it in the trunk. On our way again, I explained the plate removal to my passengers and that it appeared we must now consider ourselves outside agitators. So our excitement was muted by apprehension. And a couple of hours further on, we checked into the small Thomas Jefferson Hotel in Birmingham. And now we jump to the morning of March 25th. At dawn, the five Canadians find themselves near the front of the march, carrying their sign, "Unitarians for Freedom Now." Our section started off at 8 a.m., not far from the front and the SCLC leaders. All the men with Dr. King were wearing dark blue suits and sunglasses, as was King himself, in order to make it harder to spot him in case there were snipers along the way. We soon began singing, "We Shall Overcome Someday," led by the lusty-voiced marshals. Lining the roadways and the streets were the federalized Alabama National Guard and many U.S. military police, but no local police. Nevertheless, there were plenty of people holding up Confederate flags on both sides, and we were continually taunted with shouts of "white niggers" and "commie anarchists." And while still in the suburbs, I saw more than one pickup truck with a crude sign, "Ammo here, cheap," and several cars with "Yankee trash, go home," and "Welcome to Coon Country." Occasionally someone would run out shouting slurs or spitting on us, but a guardsman would pull them back. Nevertheless, the majority of spectators lining both sides of the street watched the mass of marchers with a sort of bewildered and astonished gaze. And we know how the story ends. The march was successfully completed. And although Governor Wallace did not come out to meet with the marchers and accept their petition, the simple fact that 35,000 people walked without incident from Selma to Montgomery on that March day in 1965 heralded the beginning of the end of the denial of democratic rights for blacks in the American South. I cannot begin to explain to you the euphoria in the crowd. It was tangible, infectious. It was overwhelming. And it was without a doubt the highlight of my life, I can assure you. In the years following these momentous days, Canadians continued to pay attention to the events in southern Alabama. Both the Vancouver Church and the Hamilton Church in Ontario sent financial support to the families and communities who were impacted by the violence. Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't just talking about getting the vote for the black people of Alabama. He was talking about a bigger picture than that, a much bigger picture. He did have a dream, and it's not just an American dream. He had a vision of a society where the layers between racial colors didn't crackle with tension, a vision of a country or a world that wasn't divided by any sort of lines, where the working poor weren't stigmatized, where the rich aren't building walls of fear, where all peoples are treated with dignity and respect. In Canada, we have our own shameful apartheid, and we are hardly able to acknowledge it. Last year, the Truth and Reconciliation Program concluded 5 years of bringing forward stories of how the churches and the Canadian government treated Aboriginal children through residential schools. A system whose purpose was to, quote, kill the Indian in the child. It was a system of cultural genocide. We have spoken on this issue in the past, and we will continue until we have brought our principles into alignment with our actions, and the stories of the past have all been revealed. The damage healed as best it can, and we have softened the hard lines of color, race, and economic disparity in this country. There is work to do. I would like to end with a thought from one of Canada's preeminent playwrights, Thompson Highway, an Aboriginal Canadian, a man who writes for his living. Highway says, "I think that every society is constantly in a state of change, of transformation, of metamorphosis. I think that it is very important that it continue to be so, to prevent the stagnation of our imaginations and our spirits and our souls. What I really find fascinating about the future of my life, the life of my people, the life of my fellow Canadians, is the searching for this new voice, this new identity, this new tradition, this magical transformation that potentially is quite magnificent. It is the combination of the best of both worlds, combining them and coming up with something new." We all have our stories to tell, the stories of who and what we are. Americans are working on their story. Canada is working on its story too. We have different histories, different roots. We see our worlds through different eyes. But perhaps Martin Luther King and Thompson Highway are saying the same thing, that the vision that Canada and the United States have is a both-and story. And I hope, for all our sakes, it is a story of transformation. So be it.